The lichens weren't actually my idea to begin with. Some months ago, my friend Claire, now the Reverend Claire Eustace, asked if I would preach in her ordination service, which was last month. And I asked her if there were any themes other than ministry, and she said, lichens. She meant it. I'm not sure she knew what a biology nerd I am, but she found out, and so will you. But first, I have some other things to talk about before we get around to the lichens. And yes, the story that that Kat chose was very appropriate. She really has a knack for that. Now, what I want to talk about is Unitarian Universalism, this particular faith. Ordinations, since Claire got my brain running along those lines, they remind me of that particular fact. Because two of the most visible moments of that forging were ordination sermons. One delivered in 1819 by William Ellery Channing, and the other by Theodore Parker in 1841. They were in the midst of numerous crises, which I'll come back to in a bit, and they responded with two sermons that, well, together they added up to about 3 hours long, but don't worry. I won't go nearly half that long. And they laid out a picture of how we could respond. In a time that they were being told, you know, your faith response is no religion at all, really. Channing responded to a wave of evangelical Christianity that was happening in the country, the Second Great Awakening with its emotional excesses, and Parker was responding to biblical literalism. And Channing was pointing us to our God-given faculties for moral reasoning. He said we have a moral grounding as well as an emotional one. And Parker was pointing us to our ability to discern what in religion was transient and what was permanent, that we had more to guide us than a human written work that could not be true for all things and always. Channing and Parker really believed that the world needed this faith. And so they explained how, each in about 90 minutes. You are comfortable, right? You're good where you are? Okay. So we also live in a time of crisis. Crises, I mean, right? Don't you wish it were just one? So I'm wondering, do we believe that our faith was made for such a time as this? Do we really believe it? Many voices will say that it isn't. That a religion that values reason isn't a real religion. Just a list of namby-pamby values or principles that, without a unifying doctrine or scripture, were just religion light at best. You will hear this from people in other faiths. You'll hear it sometimes from people in our congregations, and maybe now and then, like me, you'll hear it in your own heart. Friends, it is not true. We are exactly what this world needs, and this world needs a lot. We are not a pale imitation of real red-blooded religion, but as real and gritty and as vital as it gets. And there are a lot of pieces of our life-giving message that I could pull out, but I want to sum up just one today, one in one word, and that is interdependence. or to get concrete lichens. This is where the lichens come in. Got them for me there, Tim. They're also gorgeous, so, okay? So, lichens, you probably know, you know, from the way they appear on trees and rocks like this, they're flat. You may not know that they take many, 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 many shapes. So you've got this, the kind of flat, and then you've got the curly. These all have technical names, of course. They come in many colors. Let's see the next ones. So here's shades of green, but they also come in black. And they also come in, next slide, red. I know, aren't those amazing? These, by the way, do not hurt the trees. If you see lichen all over a tree, it is not a sign of ill health in the tree. Do not worry. They just use the tree as a substrate, and it's fine for the tree. They come in lots of different forms, as I said. If you see the next page, you're very familiar, probably, the next slide, I'm sorry. These are not as familiar, this cup-shaped ones, maybe, although once you know to look out for them, these are a form of lichen, and you'll see them. And the next slide, oh, wow, there are more forms than I remembered, so lots of little flowers. Fructose or something is called that shape, the fruiting shape of it. Now the next slide. Yeah, that's the one I was waiting for, because the ones on the left you probably know really well. They get called Spanish moss sometimes, but that's a different plant. We see these often in Muir Woods and so on, any of our forests around here, draping down these ones on the left that look like hair. They're not moss, and they're a kind of lichen. And then the ones in the middle, you get, oop, don't switch away from it yet. Oh, just somebody popped up. Will you make that big for me again, Tim? The one in the middle, you get a closer up look on it on the right. We have a California state lichen, and that's it. Isn't that gorgeous? Talk about the interdependent web. That's called a lace lichen. And from a distance, as you can see, it looks kind of like that hair because it all clumps together, but it's this really gorgeous, you stretch it out, and it's a gorgeous sort of lace shape. Lichen grow on all sorts of surfaces, trees and rocks and gravestones. Of course, we know them from that. But also, next slide, they grow... Oh, not about the surfaces, I'm getting ahead of myself. I wanted you to know they grow on every continent. And here is proof, they grow even in Antarctica. You may already know that they grow on the other end of the planet because reindeer live almost entirely on lichen in the winter. Can we get the next slide on that? So these are lichen at the Arctic end of the planet, and they thrive under the snow all winter in Arctic conditions, and so the caribou nuzzle under the snow there to eat them when everything else is dead. Now the next picture will show us some of the amazing places they grow. Stone in many, many patterns and many different types of stone. I love these sort of circular ones. And then on the next slide, they'll grow on the shells of a Galapagos tortoise. Again, tortoise doesn't mind. I don't know whether they talk to each other like in Cat's story, but there they are doing their thing. And on the next slide, they'll grow even on glass and on plastic. They're so amazing. There seems to be nowhere that they can't survive. Incredible ranges of climate, hot to cold. The next slide shows they can even grow on sand. On sand. And so they grow in very hot dunes on Earth, too. I think that's our last slide, Tim. Is that right? So I'm going to tell you a little bit more about how. But just to see what an amazing example they are of adaptation to the many, many circumstances and habitats that are available here on Earth, including ones that we've only come up with well into their existence, like glass and plastic. They also can be lived to be incredibly old. The oldest known specimen is believed to be over 9,000 years old. So, you know, our oldest redwoods here, when they were just little sprouts, that guy was already 7,000 years old. Whole different sense of scale and ability to to thrive. Now, scientists find them fascinating because they are a living example of something that first happened about 3 billion years ago, and that has happened numerous times, but we don't know exactly how. I should say, it didn't happen first with lichen. They're quite a recent development. But studying them can tell us something about maybe how it happened to begin with. And that is the movement from unicellular to multicellular beings. For a long time, of course, there was no life on Earth at all. And then for a very long time, there were only unicellular beings. Already that incredible leap to living things that could split and divide, eat and excrete and continue life. They carried on like that for about 1 billion years, and then along came multicellular beings. That would be the trees of green and the red roses too, and the friends shaking hands saying, how do you do? You and me and everything, these multicellular, amazingly complex creations. Why do lichens provide a key for how that might have happened? Because they are symbiotic. They are actually a composition, a colony of bacteria, and they each help the other. The fungus can't create food by itself. Fungi don't have any chlorophyll and can't photosynthesize. So being a host to the alga, I'm just going to say alga from now on, or algae because cyanobacteria is long, sorry. And being a host to them lets them partake of the food that the algae can make. And the algae get out of it a structure that might make them able to live in conditions such as these incredible cold and heat. And how they do that is a whole other story. But here's what's incredible. It's not just that they live side by side. You know, it's not like a crocodile. There's lots of symbiotic relationships in nature, of course. Probably more symbiosis than things living individually. Again, interdependence. But it's not like, you know, a little bird, one organism riding on back of little crocodile and, you know, eating the bugs off it and so on, right? There's lots of symbiotic relationships like that. The fungus actually takes the algae into its body. The algae cells become part of the new organism, and thus you have this lichen, which is a new organism. Formerly two, and now one. Formerly simpler, and now more complex. Are they two species or one, lichens? Yes. So interdependence is a fact. This is not this exact case, but something like this that we can watch in real time if we watch fungi and algae becoming lichen today and see how they work. Something like that is how we got from a planet of amoebas to this. Not to diss amoebas, they're cool. Okay. But I'm glad that we have the roses and each other. It started with interdependence. It started with two single-celled critters finding a way to so intertwine their lives that they became a new thing and could live in conditions and grow in complexity in ways that they could never have done alone. A lichen is actually an ecosystem. And as you probably know, so is a human being. Each of us, an entire ecosystem. Some of our cells were once other creatures, and we can't live without the colonies of bacteria and other things that live in our gut, in our eyes, and all sorts. In what way are we therefore just one thing? With lichen, it's part of the secret of their success. They thrive because they are interdependent, because their I is really a we, and their we is an I. And so do we. Ana Castillo spoke of that in our centering words. To help heal your sadness and anger, heal the sadness and anger of others. That's how we work. When we embrace our interdependence, when we reach out beyond ourselves and take into ourselves some concern of someone else's, and when they do that for us, we thrive. I'm reminded as well of that beautiful poem that Lynn Unger wrote called Pandemic, early in the pandemic, when we first all went inside. She wrote about this as a kind of Sabbath, and in the course of that poem, she said, "Know that we are connected in ways that are terrifying and beautiful. You could hardly deny it now. Know that our lives are in one another's hands. Surely that has come clear." We get those wake-ups once in a while, and that was one of them. And then we forget. But here are the lichens to remind us. We need reminding. The lie that this is not so, that interdependence is dispensable or worse, an evil, is everywhere. It's everywhere. In politics and economics, we've gone in recent decades from having a kind of mixed economy where people generally understand whatever party they are, that we are a mix of capitalism, people owning things on their own, and socialism, people sharing resources in order to better thrive. Some people have decided that the more individualistic, the more capitalistic we get, the better. It's not true. It's a lie of hyper-individualism. We have it in religion, where there's an American obsession with individual salvation, as if that is the purpose for which Jesus came, for example, is so that each individual spirit can have a relationship with him and be saved, and devil take the rest. And of course, this lie that we can do without interdependence is rife in our attitude toward the environment. One species is highest, and we should just worry about that species, and what happens to the rest is really not our concern. We know that's not true. But people will tell it to us all the time. All of these forms of this lie deal death. And we have the life-giving theology to counter them all. Politically, economically, spiritually, environmentally, we have ways of showing we are all one. We are not our own. Perhaps it took a tradition so steeped in the Enlightenment and individual rights and the understanding of the dignity of each person to be able to assert, and we're not our own, each sacred individual. We are interdependent. We cannot live without one another. So lichens are a metaphor, but also an example, a demonstration of this rule of life. It's not an exception, symbiosis. It's more common than the alternative. Biologically, we are not our own. We are each other's. And the crises of our time arise over and over again from this lie. So we can help to respond to them with our truth. Now, Channing and Parker, as I said, they were in all sorts of crises of the time, some of which they might not know, have known are crises. But it's interesting to look back at the things that were happening in their time, first half of the 19th century. White and male supremacy declared at the time that one fraction of humanity is the best and should make decisions for everyone else. It was the law of the land that black lives were dispensable, that they should be ruled over. War of their time, the colonial wars of their times, that great failure to acknowledge interdependence. Wars of resources, of the growth of empire. It's only gotten worse in our time with our weapons. While we continue to wonder whether people who are not male and not white should have control over their own bodies and their own decisions. And then, of course, the environmental crisis. Well, that's one that Channing and Parker probably could not have even imagined. They couldn't have imagined our weapons, and they could not have imagined that simply by living, an unimaginable almost 8 billion of us, we could threaten other species of life on Earth until the point, to the point that we threatened ourselves. And yet there they were, responding to racism, to biblical literalism, to a disdain for reason and a love of war. This religion was forged in crisis. And we were made to respond to the crises of our time. It saves lives, it saves souls, it can save the world. And the good news is, it's good news. Sister Rebecca Solnit has taught us so. Imagine if we lived interdependently, if we said, oh, we are actually happier and better off. What matters to us most is not burning as many fossil fuels as possible, buying as much stuff as possible, living as heedlessly as possible, but living interdependently in connection and community. That is where our joy is. Imagine if we lived that way. Well, it wouldn't feel, as she says, like austerity. What feels like austerity is living as if we're all separate and isolated, like we have to do it alone. Like our grief is something we must face all by ourselves. Like our troubles are something that no one else can help us with. It has never been so. It's a lie. And if we live as if we are alone in a harsh world, it's not only not true, that is austerity to beat all austerity. So Solnit asks us to imagine that our true wealth is in connection, in community, in the ways we depend on each other and care for each other. She asks us to imagine that that is so because it is. And that's why there is nothing watered down about Unitarian Universalism. We have this message that the world needs. We're not the only religion that has it, luckily. But preaching and living interdependence, you know, if we will claim that, if we will love it and preach it and teach it and live it, we will be transformed. And by we, I mean the whole, interwoven, interconnected, interdependent, aching, beautiful world. So let's do it.